Yo, Weeks is Gila Kuzla. My name is Gordy Hill, not Carol Martin. I'm from the Kwakwaka'wakw Nation, as my brother Gert mentioned. And my people's territory is on North Vancouver Island. And I've lived in the city of Vancouver for about half my life. I'd like to first begin by acknowledging that we are on Coast Salish territory, occupied Coast Salish territory, and to welcome everybody here who's from out of the city to our currently Olympic-occupied police state that we're surviving in and living in here for the next month or so. And if you happen to have a chance to go downtown, you'll be able to get a glimpse of this police state that they've established to protect the rich and powerful and their corporate circus and the corporations and all the other ruling elites that they've invited here from around the world to have a two-week party on the backs of the poor who are going to pay for it and the people who are going to pay for this circus. I'm a really keen student of history, because history tells you how you came to be where you are today. And history, in the hands of the oppressed and in the context of a struggle, is a weapon. It's a weapon for the mind, because it illuminates and it enlightens you as to how you came to be where you are today. And one thing about the Olympic industry, this multi-billion dollar industry, if you look at the history of it and you consider, why are we even talking about the Olympics here in North America in 2010? And if you consider it, it's because of the history of colonialism and imperialism that the Western system has imposed around the world to the extent that today it is a global system. And one of my other brothers, Harjap, he was talking at a press conference the other day, and he talked about how the International Olympic Committee is no different than the International Monetary Fund or the World Trade Organization or the Free Trade Area of the Americas or any of these other global institutions. And his point was, because they transfer money from the people to the rich and powerful, to the corporations and to the governments. And if you consider this history of colonialism and imperialism, which has brought us to where we are today, then you have a better understanding of why the IOC, VANOC, the Vancouver Olympic Organizing Committee, and all the other aspects of the Olympic industry, if you consider that history, then you know why they have such a close tie to these colonial and fascist elites which make up the IOC. One of their most spectacular Olympics they ever held was the 1936 Nazi Olympics. And you know, today they talk about having thousands of people out on the streets to cheer the Olympic torch, which the Nazis designed and which they ran through Western Europe, through all the countries that they subsequently occupied. And when you think about that history, the IOC, VANOC, the Olympic torch, you know, today they're going to say, oh, we had thousands of people out cheering the torch relay as across the country. We're going to have 250,000 people here coming to Vancouver to participate in the Olympics, to be spectators. Well, you know, in the Nazi Olympics in 1936, they had 2 million people come to Berlin to watch the Olympics. So it doesn't mean anything to me if they have 250,000, 300,000, 500,000 spectators come. Because when the Nazis control the state institutions and the corporate elite run the media and run the propaganda campaigns, which they learned from Joseph Goebbels, from the Nazi Party, and during the Nazi Olympics and up to World War II, it doesn't mean anything to me, because they control the system and they're able to indoctrinate the population to agree with these kinds of spectacles. Now, over the last 2 to 3 years, we've organized our resistance movement against the Olympic industry. We studied the previous Olympics, including the 1936 Nazi Olympics, Mexico 1968, where hundreds of students were massacred 10 days before the Olympic Games began, part of the effort of the government to impose an Olympic peace, because there was a huge social resistance that had emerged in Mexico at the time of the Olympics. Seoul 1988, Beijing 2008, all these Olympics, we looked at them and we studied them. Sydney 2000. Sydney 2000 was very important because, like Canada, it's a colonial state with an Aboriginal population. And we studied, how did the Aboriginal people organize themselves? how did the non-Aboriginal social movements organize, and how did they, what kind of repression did they face from the government and the Olympic industry there? So we studied all these previous Olympic Games, and we committed ourselves to fight this industry. And once we realized the extent of the negative social and environmental impacts that it was going to have on the city, on the people, on the region, on the land, you know, we kept up our resistance. And one of our main slogans we used through the Olympic Resistance Network was "No Olympics on Stolen Native Land." And we used that slogan successfully to raise the anti-colonial consciousness of Indigenous peoples and our non-Indigenous allies in other social movements. And you see that slogan was raised across the country during our protests against the Spirit Train or the Olympic Torch Relay. And we want to thank all those people who've come from other regions and those people in other parts of the country who participated in that resistance and who raised the banner of anti-Olympic resistance. Briefly, the reason we used that slogan, "No Olympics on Stolen Native Land," is to highlight the colonial history here in British Columbia, where the government, we assert, is an illegal and immoral entity that lacks legal jurisdiction to govern here in the so-called province of British Columbia. Because we say these are sovereign native lands, even according to Canadian, British, and international law, which is why we say they violate their own laws. So people cannot be bound to follow the rules of a corrupt government as we have here today. In 1849, as many of you may know, the Hudson's Bay Company was made the governor of the new colony, Vancouver Island. The Hudson's Bay Company, one of the oldest corporations in the world, today one of the main sponsors for the Olympics. And under their regime, they began to make a number of treaties, which are known as the Douglas Treaties on Vancouver Island, so-called after the first governor of the province, James Douglas. But after he made about a dozen treaties, they decided there was no longer any point in making these treaties because now their Western expansion across the country had been completed, and they were setting themselves up for the invasion, the occupation, the settlement, the resource exploitation of these lands here. And in 1858, there was a gold rush in the Fraser Valley. Tens of thousands of settlers invaded into the Fraser Valley region, began a renewed process of colonialism there. In 1862, there was a massive smallpox epidemic that killed 1 in 3 Indigenous peoples here in the province. In the 1870s, British Columbia was made a colony, or was made a part of the Canadian Federation. In 1875, the BC provincial government passed a Lands Act, part of their attempt to open up lands for another process of settlement, to open up lands for new settlers to come in. And that same year, the federal government struck down the BC Lands Act, claiming it was illegal because the government had not gained the legal surrender of Indigenous territories. In other words, they had not made any treaties. And that was the treaty making was the basis of British and later Canadian expansion across the West. And that's why today we have the number treaties, such as Treaty Number 1, Treaty Number 2, that spread across the prairies. When the federal government issued that duty of disallowance, the provincial government threatened to withdraw from Confederation. And the next year, in 1876, Canada passed the Indian Act, which imposed federal government control over all Indigenous peoples and their lands, imposed the band council system, including those in BC who had never signed any treaties or surrendered any land to the government. After the first phase of colonialism here in the province, which was characterized by the use of Royal Navy gunboats, which sailed up and down the coast and imposed colonial rule on all the native villages, any transgressions against settlers, the Royal Navy was sent in. They bombarded many villages on the coast. They sent in Royal Marines who burned abandoned villages, destroyed their food stocks, destroyed canoes. And after this period of colonial violence, which they hide in their tourist type of history for the province, After this phase of colonial violence, the indigenous people were subjected to the residential school, the regime of the band council run by Indian agents. And there, at that same time, there began a legal and political struggle by indigenous peoples. Because this history that I'm recounting about this illegal possession of a native lands, our peoples here have fought for over 100 years and proclaimed their sovereignty against the government. So this is not a new struggle. And we are just the current generations that carry on this struggle. But even that was too much for the government. And in 1927, they amended the Indian Act and outlawed land claims organizing. And it was not until the 1950s that a lot of these restrictions of the Indian Act were lifted. Although, you know, today the Indian Act still exists. And these band counselors, particularly those in the four host First Nations, which are comprised of the Indian Act chiefs and councils, you know, I've always been saying these people are nothing but government collaborators. Their role has been historically to impose government policies on the people, to control indigenous peoples, and that's the same function the four host First Nations are carrying out today. They're collaborating with the government, they're collaborating with the Olympic industry, they're collaborating to make it look like Canada has a just and harmonious relationship with indigenous peoples, and our resistance movement, indigenous peoples in this province and across the country, have said, no, this is a lie, because indigenous peoples here suffer the worst rates of poverty, homelessness, violent death, suicide, poor health, disease, poor housing, bad water, the worst life indicators among all the people in this country are suffered by indigenous peoples. There's over 500 missing and murdered Native women across the country. Here in the downtown east side of Vancouver, there's over 70 missing and murdered Native women. And the government wants to have this Olympics and say everything's great here, the most inclusive for Native people. We're the best country in the world. We got the best human rights record. And our resistance movement has shown that to be a lie, and we've confronted it. We drove Bannock off the streets so they no longer hold public celebrations here. And on February 12th, and when the Olympic Games begin, and for days afterwards, we're going to be in the streets to confront the Olympic police state, the Olympic industry, to show to the country, to the world, that there's resistance here, that the Olympic industry is a destructive industry that benefits only the rich and powerful, and that devastates poor indigenous peoples and the land. And the one thing, and before I finish, I want to acknowledge also our elder Harriet Nahaney from the Pachidat Nation on Vancouver Island, who resisted the Olympics in 2006, took part in the blockade on Eagle Ridge Bluffs against the expansion of the Sea to Sky Highway. And in 2007, she was in prison for 2 weeks, where she contracted pneumonia. And shortly after her release from prison, she died February 24th, 2007. The final thing I want to say is that, you know, they talk about Olympic legacies, and we hope to leave an Olympic legacy as well, a legacy of resistance, a legacy of struggle, and one that's going to continue into the future, because the real struggle, the real conflict here is going to begin after the Olympics, because they bought off all the collaborators they could, they paid off all the people who would take their dirty money. But afterwards, now, the government, $3 billion debt, they're not going to have that kind of money to buy people off. The labor unions who bought into it with their Olympic contracts, some of which are going to start to expire in March 2010. You know, we're still going to be here. Our resistance movement is going to be here. The homeless people are going to be here. But you know who's not going to be here? 17,000 pig security, police, soldiers. They're not going to be here. But we're still going to be here. And after the Olympics, this struggle is far from over. And we are going to make the rich and powerful pay. Gila Kasla.
Thank you.